Hello all, welcome to the God Setebos podcast, a content channel of Kai Draconis Books. I'm the editor of Kai Draconis Books, Patrick Barney. If you've been listening to the podcast or seen any of the press's videos, you'll know who I am. You know, I'm not of any consequence for this discussion. Just a reminder, go to kaidraconis.org. That's kaidraconis.org to check out the press, to look at our publications, to, you know, just find out what's going on with the press. You can friend me on Facebook, follow the press on Twitter or on Facebook. All our content is free to reflect our anarchist values, we believe money shouldn't be involved with art, and, you know, to kind of, as a statement against commodification, all our content, including our books and whatnot, is free. Also, you can subscribe to the podcast through iTunes if you would like to do so, and that way, you know, you don't have to be on the lookout for my announcements about the podcast. You can just get it in, get an alert, an email alert, by subscribing on iTunes. So today I'm with a special guest, Chris Malmberg. He's I'm going to let him introduce himself. We're going to talk about an American classic, Herman Melville's Moby Dick. Which is just fantastic. But first, Chris, introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Chris Malmberg, and I studied literature with Patrick Barney at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and have continued to study literature since in my own time. Moby Dick, I don't know if you want me to introduce that or not, Patrick, but one of the reasons that I think we're talking about it is I'd read it before and was really kind of blown away by it in so many different ways. The way that, like, everyone would be familiar with is that you hear that something is good for the longest time or great for the longest time, and I guess it doesn't penetrate a certain barrier in your mind and you just don't pick it up. So forever I heard that Moby Dick was great, I read it finally a few years ago, maybe 2-3 years ago, it was actually the one book on, one of two or three books on my comps list that, for graduate school that I didn't pick up. That's hilarious. Hilarious, I know. That's me admitting to something that,
I read every should probably on be my comps list. Every single one, except for one that was out of print. That was the only one.
Okay, well, and we all strive to measure up, Pat.
Understandable. It's hard to measure up to me.
So, I read it a few years ago, and it just blew my mind. It is incredibly beautifully written, line by line. It is just incredible, not only that, I feel like I heard before that, like, it's a book that has everything in it, and it does seem to try to have everything in it, or it seems to try it. I might be talking about what it seems to be trying to be doing, but it is an immense book. It is encompassing. It's both. It really dives deep into religiosity and science and myth-making and realism. And it seems to be really just dive, like, the seams that separate those seemingly mutually exclusive things. It just defies, it defies description. It's an incredible book. It's exciting. It's horrifying. It's absolutely horrifying. It's funny. It's really funny. It's got it all. So
it,
good.
It is hilarious.
I'm delighted to talk about it.
I know this is, maybe some people will think this is sacrilege, but I actually don't, traditionally, I don't read books anymore. I listen to them on audiobook. Just because I have three kids and I have no time to read. So the only time I can read is like when I'm driving from work, when I'm doing my like daily exercise, you know. So I actually am able to read a lot more right now, by listening to books on audiobook. So basically is preliminary to say that I'll be talking about how I listened to Moby Dick for this podcast.
That's great because like I listened to it the first time.
Oh, did you?
I did, and I listened to it for part of this time because of time. You know, like right. I couldn't. You know, I like you. I'm commuting and stuff like that, and so I have a text copy and an audiobook copy.
Right.
That I was bouncing between. So I've read two thirds of it as text, and I've listened to it one and a third times.
Alright. When I listen to Moby Dick, this is the first time that I've ever encountered the book. One of my first reactions was, whoa, this is hilarious. Ishmael is a snappy narrator. He is funny. So that was something that I noticed right away, which I thought was cool. I didn't think it would be funny, but it's you know, he's pretty much an ironic narrator, I would say.
Absolutely, and he is, there's like a lot of, it feels like at the beginning of the book, like it might just be a comedy.
Right.
The way that he handles like the scene where Queequeg like returns to their shared room, not knowing that Ishmael is in the bed, basically naked.
Yeah,
and then Ishmael feels like he can't say anything, and then Queequeg gets in bed, and then like Ishmael screams, and then Queequeg starts to feel him, absolutely hilarious.
And when Queequeg signs up for the Pequod, one of the captains, there are two captains,
Peleg and it's Bergen or Bergdahl like that.
Balshan or whatever. But anyway, like, Peleg sees Queequeg do his, like, harpoon thing, and he's really good. And he's like, oh, we need to sign on Ye Quahog or Hedgehog.
Yeah, Quahog, Hedgehog, yeah. He's so excited. But he's such a bore, you know, he doesn't bother learning the guy's name.
Yeah, he's just like, we need to sign on Ye Hedgehog right away. It's hilarious.
Oh yeah, no, and just the that was Peleg, and his ramblings about you know, don't talk to me about the merchant, you know, merchant fish, seaman, and like that's not the real thing. And it feels almost like there's a collection of stories that came out of the early mid-century called Glencannon. They're the Glencannon novels, and they're about a British sailor and his like misadventures, and probably like the closest thing to like the easiest way to describe it would be like to imagine MASH. like the show MASH, but in book form and set in like the 30s, and it's a British sailor, and that it's the tone of the early chapters of Moby Dick is very much like that. It just feels light and funny and even kind of warm and funny. You know, like the relationship between Ishmael and Queequeg is very sweet and like not like the super sincere and the type of like sort of like brotherly love that like you're like, oh, this is awesome. You know, like these two like mismatched pair, cannibal, you know, I don't remember what islands he's from.
I don't think it says, but I think it's New Zealand.
Yeah. So Maori. Yeah.
He's probably a Maori is what I would guess.
Yeah. I think he's styled on that because of the facial tattooing and all of that. But Polynesian in any case, one of the Polynesian islands and who's massive and imposing and then this like, I remember what it was like, Peleg describes Ishmael's, voice, not his voice, but how he chooses words. He speaks like softly, with soft words because he's so eloquent and verbose. And you get like little snippets of this in the beginning where he just sort of swamps people with like really long, like questions. And, you know, he's just super enthusiastic, and articulate. And you know, you just imagine this, you know, kind of waspy sort of like 20-something smart ass hanging out with this, you know, quiet, imposing, thick, huge, like cannibal warrior. Right. And it's just delightful. I mean, they're so fun.
It is. I agree. You know, when I, you know, in those early chapters, I felt like, oh, this is going to be like a tract on cross-cultural friendship. And I won't say that it's not necessarily like, I do think that crossing cultures and multiculturalism is a big thing in the novel. I think that's a major theme that Melville is trying to go for. But at the same time, you know, the novel isn't like this big narrative of a friendship, you know?
Yeah, no, I think, you know, I mean, just to, you know, pull from the text, I have the quote here, you know, where Queequeg and Ishmael have come to an understanding that they're going to share this room. Mm-hmm. And Queequeg says, "Me savvy plenty, you get in," motioning me with his tomahawk and throwing the clothes to one side. He's motioned to bed. He really did this in not only a civil but a really kind and charitable way. I stood looking at him a moment. For all his tattooings, he was, on the whole, a clean, comely-looking cannibal. "What's all this fuss I've been making about?" I thought to myself. "A man's a human being just as I am. The man's a human being just as I am. He has just as much reason to fear me as I have to be afraid of him. Better sleep with a sober cannibal than a drunken Christian."
Yeah, I totally remember that line. It's so good. It's such a great line.
It is great. And it feels like it's going to be making some kind of argument about it, and you're saying, and I agree, that it ultimately doesn't.
Right.
It's not the point.
Right. I mean, I do think, I absolutely believe that there's this, the theme of multiculturalism is a motif in the novel. It just isn't explored exclusively through the friendship between Queequeg, and I'm going after Peleg and calling him Quahog. It isn't exclusively explored between Ishmael and Queequeg. I do think, however, that it is continued throughout the novel as a motif, when we get these kind of poetic and wonderful descriptions of whales and their habits and their you know, their biology and whatnot. And there's a specific moment when the Pequod comes upon a huge pod of whales, and they're all in a circle, and as they get closer, they look down and they see mothers nursing the calves, right? The calf whales. And at that moment, when I was listening to that moment, like, I had this kind of light bulb moment where I was like, oh, okay, so this is an attempt. The novel is at least partially an attempt, and I don't like the word the other. I don't particularly like that as a concept, because I feel like it's got all these postmodern connotations, but that's beside the point. But I feel like the novel is an attempt to say that the other is not totally other. Does that make sense? Like, yeah. the foreign or the alien or the mysterious can be understood. You can bridge the gap from oneself to the alien. And I guess I don't like the term the other in this respect, because the other, I mean, the whole point of the other is that it is unbridgeable, right? Yeah. Like, the gap between you and the other is unbridgeable. And I feel like, at least partially, this novel is saying that that's not true. And, you know, he was writing way before any of this critical theory stuff emerged. But I think that the novel is an attempt to understand the alien.
Yeah. Well, there's another scene where Ahab is, like, kind of at the height of being Ahab.
Yeah.
It's close to the end, and he is hanging out with Pip, the young sort of cabin boy,
yeah.
Black, you know,
black.
and insane. Because he was left in the ocean for a period of time.
That was so heartbreaking.
It's horrifying, yeah.
Like, Pip, when he goes on the journey, is incredibly smart, and then they leave him in the ocean for an hour, and he comes back totally screwed.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, and that's a beautiful but terrible scene, by the way.
Yeah,
it
is.
How it's described that... the world ever widened around Pip as the ships sailed away.
Yeah.
To the limit, to the extent that, like, you know, basically it's like kind of like pulling the rug out from under you, but in this case it's pulling the rug out from under your sanity.
Yeah.
And his soul sank and drowned, but his body lived.
Yeah, like
it's and then, horrifying.
Oh, and then later when Queequeg is sick and they think he's dying, Pip is like, hey, when you go over to the other side, look for Pip. Find Pip and you know, keep him company. Because
yes.
He's not Pip anymore.
I know, exactly.
Oh, man. Anyway.
It's, yeah, but Ahab has this moment, maybe, I have questions about Ahab that I didn't have before, and I was want to ask you about Ahab. But maybe the most sincere moment that Ahab has of another human being, which is, you know, like, you know, please, he's asking Pip to, like, not be around him because it makes him feel like this is something that he shouldn't be doing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's basically unmanning him. I don't remember the exact words, but it is kind of a touching, you know, where you see this older white man who is obviously insane and driven to the extent that he doesn't care about the lives of the people he is responsible for, but he feels sadness for this young, you know, Black Boy, and they have a kind of a moment where Pip comes out of his insanity and actually kind of talks to Ahab. And you know, there's a lot of these, you know, like where I think like the rich like menagerie of people and backgrounds. You have, I think, Fadala, who is an Arab or Islamic. And you have Digo, who's this, you know, massive black man, and you have Queequeg and Teshtigo, and you have all of these, you know, this sort of rich tapestry of humanity, and it is mirrored by this rich tapestry of animal kind too, because Ishmael spends so much time describing the ecosystem, the biology, the almost like the culture of whales, and it's definitely just embracing all of it and everyone.
Absolutely. And then actually, are you familiar with Toni Morrison's Blackness in the Literary Imagination?
No.
Okay, so I actually had to read that for one of my an American lit class that I took at UAF. It was with Jennifer Schnell or Shell. So I don't know if you had her, but anyway, most of Morrison's book is a comparison between Moby Dick and the works of Edgar Allan Poe, and she, basically what she does is she sets up how each of the authors, how Melville and Poe use and discuss the colors blackness and whiteness. And what we find, Morrison says, is that underlying Poe's assumptions about whiteness and blackness are racist ideas, basically. You know, like Poe uses whiteness and blackness and juxtaposes them in such a way as to, you know, kind of show how blackness is a negative thing. And Melville, she says, on the other hand, is you know, I think that for our time, we would say that Melville has racist ideas, but only if we judge him by our own standards. If we judge him by his own standards, I think he's probably, I think that he was extremely advanced as far as ideas about race is concerned for his time.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
I think that makes a lot of sense. He characterizes Dagoo and Pip,
right,
and Fleece, the cook, I think are the three black men aboard the Pequot. And Queequeg and Fadala, you know, also being, you know, of different ethnicities, he characterizes them to some extent through easier stereotypes. I think it might boil down to just, you know, his own experience,
right,
with people. I mean, you know, like when you're a writer, you kind of have to make people like feel that this is a person from, you know, that distinct ethnicity or culture,
right,
in a way that, you know, like is not necessarily like racially motivated. It's just so that when someone's reading the book, they feel that this isn't just, you know, like a white person who's been painted black, you
right,
know, or,
right,
you know, so, and that's always very hard, obviously, but we have much more like information and cultural awareness of these different ethnicities now, right, so that we don't have to draw upon, you know, certain symbols or, you know, characteristics to make people feel that way. And, you know, it makes me wonder, like, if you really looked at the book closely, if you could sort of see, like, because Queequeg is the one that we get the most information about,
right,
and the one that we see the most. And it also happens to be the case that Melville was marooned on an island with cannibals for a while.
Oh, what?
So he was, yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, there's a book, Taipei, about it. It was his big hit.
It's a novel or it's a memoir?
I think it's a novelization of his experience.
And it's called
it's been T-Y-P-E-E.
Taipei.
Or okay, I don't remember if it's how it's pronounced. But
Moby Dick is the second thing I've read by Melville after Bartleby the Scrivener.
Oh, yeah.
And I love Moby Dick and I like Bartleby. I think I'm definitely a fan and I'm going to read all this stuff.
Definitely.
So I'm going to get to it. Anyway, go on.
Well, I was going to say, he might have thought as a writer, this is like the mechanics, right? Like, you know, and maybe not consciously, but he just might have been more comfortable writing closer to Queequeg.
Right.
Because he knew those people better. And Queequeg feels like a more, like, less reliant upon stereotypes. Like, he starts with the stereotypes, but he digs deeper.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that that's something that he doesn't quite do or can't quite do to the extent, same extent with Dagoo and Fadala. And
Tashtego.
Tashtego, yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I think that it, you know, it might be, you know, Melville was as inclusive and respectful as he just possibly could have been. You know, like,
yeah,
he just didn't know enough about these different peoples.
Right. But
go ahead.
Oh,
it was a different thing.
Yeah. Go on. I feel like, you know, we've definitely kind of covered the, like, multiculturalism. So if you want to move on to something else, yeah, let's talk about that.
Well, it's your thing. It's your thing.
No, dude,
you're the captain. I'm just like, you know, I'm the seaman.
Just go. Tell me what you want to talk about.
Well, leading up to this discussion, You said something along the lines of, and correct me how I described this, that this book felt like it was really about whaling,
right,
in a maybe a critical manner.
I think that's correct. It feels to me like, you know, he really, you know, it's hard to say because, like, it seems to me like the bulk of the book is actually just, like, talking about whales and what they are and what they do, right? Like,
I think that that's actually backed up by examination of the pages, yes.
Right.
It might be, yeah.
I'd have to, like, look at all the pages. I don't actually have a text copy. I just have my audiobook copy. So that's not easily scannable for the purposes of the podcast. But, you know, there are chapters and chapters and chapters that just, you know, talk about whales. And I feel like, you know, on the one hand, we could say, like, it's just Melville writing about whales. But we can't ignore the fact that it's Melville through the persona of Ishmael writing about whales. So is his point to tell us more about Ishmael, or does he just want to talk about whales? I'm not sure.
I think a case could be made that even though Ishmael does pepper his writings about whales with sort of by he returns multiple times to talk about how honorable whaling is, and how like noble it is.
Right.
I think there's a case to be made that like he's an unreliable narrator in making that those distinctions.
Okay,
so like,
sure.
Yeah, I think like he there's a kind of a sneaky way, you know, because we get through maybe almost more than half of the book anyway, maybe 2/3 before we actually see a whale killed.
Right.
And at that point, Ishmael is devoted, or Melville is devoted, a decent amount of time to talking about whales. The scene that where the first whale is killed is so horrifying. And bloody and really hard to, I remember the first time I heard it on in the audiobook, I like had to like stop the book for a little bit because it was just so bloody and beautifully written.
Yeah.
For describing what was happening. And reading it, I was just blown away by it. It's just a really hard passage. And Ishmael is like this super, he's very articulate, he's bright, he likes to talk, he likes to study everything. He's just interested in everything. And he's kind of he's kind of a useful lens for somebody who wants to not, you know, maybe write a propaganda book about whaling,
right,
but wants to kind of level out our ideas a little bit, or his contemporaries' ideas, because
right,
we can learn all about whaling and all about the whalers and all about the noble so-called project of whaling, but also learn so much about whales to the extent that it feels like it's not, you know, like you, it would have been easy to just sort of like let whales live beneath the surface of the water and not dive down into like that study. But then, you know, like what happens is it creates this, I think, like level playing field where you're forced to sort of regard whales with respect.
Right.
And maybe regard whalers with respect, but like not know, you know, this is no longer something that is just this like business.
Right.
It's larger than that.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's what I see.
No, I absolutely agree. In the early chapters, Ishmael talks about how noble it is. You know, it's a glorious pursuit. But then when we get to descriptions of killing whales, like there are very empathetic descriptions of the death of whales.
Oh yeah. And, oh, it's hard. Yeah.
Yeah. And like there's this one old barnacled whale that has like a stumpy fin that they kill, and it's like it's this occasion for Ishmael to like wax poetic about like how we're all mortals and we're all doomed. And so in that respect, it actually reminds me a lot of the Iliad. Yeah. Like I had, when I was listening to this, there was a lot of, it seemed to me very similar to Homer's epics, because in, or at least the Iliad, not so much the Odyssey, but the Iliad, in that the narrator of the Iliad is at the same time, you know, fascinated by war and fascinated by the glory of it, but then when it gets down to it and he's talking about specific soldiers dying, it's just like, you know, holy shit. Like, these people are dying horrible deaths, and, like, nobody gives a shit and nobody cares, and it's awful. you know. So like Homer has this kind of dual and contradictory narrator who both sees the glory and the terrible horror of war. And I feel like Ishmael has that same kind of contradictory position towards whaling. It's both glorious and awful.
Yeah. No, I think that that's that is a very good comparison to draw. And I think that it gets at kind of one of the wrinkles that I see in Ahab as a character. I think it's sort of Ahab, like culturally, has come to sort of represent a person who is broken and is harmful to everyone around him because he can't let go of his obsessions.
Right.
And that's certainly true, but it feels like, I mean, obviously these men respect and even sort of like idolize Ahab. And I was curious, you know, like, I feel like I can't decide the depth of Ahab's character. Like, is he just a flat character? Is he a symbol? Is he neither of those things? Is he more complicated? Like, what did you think about Ahab and his motivations and all of that?
I mean, he's a super hard character because it seems like every time you see him, he's just talking insanity to himself, you know? And just, you know, kind of, I would say, like, bolstering himself to, you know, bolstering his own hatred and his own obsession. So I don't know. Tracy told me that, and I'd never heard this before, Tracy told me that the general consensus is that the whale represents himself. I don't know, ultimately Moby Dick is Ahab somehow, and I don't know if that's true, but that's an interpretation I've heard of.
I have an impression that the whale, this is an aside from Ahab, but maybe it'll get us back to Ahab. My impression, second time through, is that the whale represents nothing. By nothing I mean like the other side of the veil. Like
it represents nothingness.
Yeah, and it represents basically, you know, the edge of everything. And and it feels like, going through this the second time, that Ishmael, because I was really trying to, because of our conversation, really trying to think about, you know, what is, you know, is there an agenda in this book? And I didn't feel like there was. It feels like in each moment there is, because right. The characters speak so directly and with such strong language about ideas all the time.
Yeah.
And Ishmael does too. But those ideas all kind of circle around each other.
Right.
And I think that one way of kind of like getting at that is to talk about how this is a book that is incredibly, I mean, like, Ishmael is incredibly fascinated with and just carried by scientific curiosity.
Right.
He is a scientist. I mean, like, not an officially one, but he loves learning.
Right.
There's a line where, there's a little cute line too, where like, he says, like, the whales have been, you know, diving and spouting for 6,000 years. And then M-dash, and however many millions before that.
Right.
You know, like, and this is, I think, 5 years prior to Darwin's Origin of Species. But he's making a little bit of a nod toward like the geological findings, and not I mean, like right around this time, the first few decades of the 1800s, that were leading some people to believe that, you know, the world is not 6,000 years old. It's right. It's older. He's a scientist.
Yeah, absolutely. But I thought that was all, an interesting line as well. I remember that. Yeah, go on.
Yeah. But he's also deeply, deeply invested in religion, mm-hmm. and religious ideas, and religious language and metaphor, and mythology, for understanding what is going on.
Right.
And it feels like Ishmael is wrapping or applying every tool in his arsenal to understand what happened, and it just doesn't work. I think it's like wrapping all human understanding and all human knowledge and all of the lenses that we have around this moment, mm-hmm. that is so sublime and massive and around this one creature, you know, it just defies everything. It is not, you know, like, it is the edge of human capability and human engineering and ingenuity and human drive. Ahab is not, like, there's not a, you know, Ahab doesn't have a flaw that ruined his chances for killing the whale. He didn't, like hesitate or anything like that. Right. There wasn't like a thing planted in his character where it was like, and this is why he lost to the whale.
Right. He's not Oedipus.
No, exactly.
Right.
Ahab gives everything he has to killing the whale. He creates like sort of pagan rituals using the blood of anneals a special harpoon in the blood, right. of his pagan harpooners.
Right. Yeah.
There's a case to be made. He's manipulating his men with a little bit of his madness. Like he's actually like using his madness to manipulate them for them to deify him. So there's a line where he is making the speech on the right before their first time. I think it was the night of the storm. He says, you know, he's making a big speech about chasing the whale and killing the whale, and he asks them like, "Are you with me?" You know, and they cheer like to hell and back or whatever. And then he mutters to himself and he says, you are like shark. He says like, you are like sharks. And they're like, yeah. And then he mutters to himself. He says, and you're also mechanical, you know, like, and it's like, you know, like how much of this, you know, and it really makes me wonder about him, you know, like, and those like mutterings and this sort of like persona, it says multiple times that he dissembles to control the narrative, mm-hmm. a little bit sometimes in order to get what he wants. You know, he's allowing regular whaling to happen because he needs to.
Right.
All he wants is the white whale. And I wonder, you know, like, you know, if I wonder about his character, I wonder like what is this, you know? Yeah, he says like, I'm the lieutenant of fate, you know, and you know, like I don't have any control. Like this is just what I've been ordered to do, but maybe that's not true. Maybe he says that to them because that sounds cool,
right?
You know, but
that makes sense.
All of this to say that, like, to come back to Ishmael, like the white whale just is impregnable. It is an impregnable creature, an impregnable mystery.
Right.
It is it defies everything that the novel throws at it. I think that's interesting because I think Ahab might be similar, you know, based on what Tracy was saying, where Ahab and the whale might represent each other a little bit or be like linked, because Ahab too is a mystery. He just wants the whale, you know, and I think that you could look at him deeper and deeper and not really know if this is something with, if he's driven by fate, if this is fated, or if he's, or if this is an obsession born of the wound that he received, and the loss of his leg, or if this is actually the culmination of his character and he would have sought out the whale anyway. You know, like, he's kind of a mystery too.
Yeah, I agree. They both seem like, you know, on the one hand, Ahab is kind of sprinkled throughout the novel, and you don't see Moby Dick till the end, but they're both like these, it seems like they're both archetypes. But like you say, like, archetypes of what? Of what's behind the veil? I don't know, but they definitely just seem like to be these two big shadows hanging over the journey of the Pequod.
They you know, I you mentioned Toni Morrison, and I feel like Beloved, it remains one of the most amazing books I've ever read, and
it's freaking fantastic.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
But part of it's how it's constructed, you know, like it feels like the story, it feels like our passage through the story orbits. What's that?
We're talking about Beloved.
Beloved, yeah.
Okay.
Our passage through that story orbits this incredibly awful moment.
Right.
Where Seth kills her child. And it orbits it both before and after, and just slowly, like, that orbit decays, and we work our way closer and closer to this thing.
Right.
That is so, so it just is, it's a singularity. It can't be broken down any further, and it breaks the world. And I feel like Moby Dick and Ahab, and kind of the construction of Moby Dick, the book, is similar. We do, you know, how long are they at sea? You know, it's not a narrative where we're like, and then there's another whale, and, you know, like, sometimes we get that hint of, like, you know, and then we saw another ship, you know, and then we saw another ship. But, like, are they out? How long are they out there for?
I mean,
you know, like,
they make it all the way to Japan, waters of Japan.
Yeah.
So I would think
it must be years.
Yeah, it must be years. Like, it would have to be years.
Yeah, and they, and it feel, and the way that, you know, like, Ishmael and or Melville behind Ishmael orders, you know, what we're introduced to and what we see, you know, that we get the whale's first whale's death, you know, almost two-thirds of the way through the novel, you know, that marks a kind of, I think, like a descent where the novel gets really dark. Like it gets like suddenly, you know, like Fleece is preaching to the sharks, and the whalers are just sort of like it feels like the language changes, even in, like, now we're like marching through like tallow up to our knees, you know, like it's thicker and it's bloodier and it's like stinkier, and it just feels suddenly like we've gone right over the lip of the well, and we're you know, now we're like, we're getting sucked down.
Right.
And I feel like, you know, it's just, it feels doomed. It just feels doomed. And,
yeah, I agree.
And I feel like the whale is just you know, this, when you say shadow, it's like, it's, you know, it is doom. It is the end,
right,
for all of us.
I think, you know, the sense of doom as the novel progresses just kind of thickens and thickens and thickens. Absolutely. But, okay. I feel like we have run out of time, but I also feel like that's an awesome place to leave it. You know, we have found our way to doom. So, was there?
Can I leave off with a quote? Because of what you said, you said about this novel being kind of a unifier, kind of a great leveler, and, you know, like, not just between humankind and different peoples, but also between different animal species. Right. Like, this is an ecological, like, it'd be very easy to say that this is like an environmentalist novel,
right?
And it made me think of one of my favorite quotes from it, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
It's when Ishmael is talking about the experience of being up, not in the crow's nest. He makes a big point of this. It's not called the crow's nest, but it is the equivalent on this whaler of the crow's nest at the top of the mast. And he's looking for whales, but he's overcome with this feeling that he describes. And he says, he's lulled into such an opium-like listlessness of vacant, unconscious reverie. This absent-minded youth, by blending the cadence of waves with thoughts, that at last... he loses his identity, takes the mystic ocean at his feet for the visible image of that deep blue bottomless soul pervading mankind and nature, and every strange half-seen gliding beautiful thing that eludes him, every dimly discovered uprising fin of some undiscernible form, seems to him the embodiment of those elusive thoughts that only people the soul by can that only people the soul by continually flitting through it. In this enchanted mood, thy spirit ebbs away to whence it came, becomes diffused through time and space, like Cramer's sprinkled pantheistic ashes, forming at last every part of every shore around the globe. And
wow.
And it's amazing.
Yeah, that's fantastic. That's amazing. And like they're like, it's that nothingness you were talking about. It's you, like, this is a journey of losing yourself and becoming diffuse with the universe.
Yeah. As Ishmael does over the course of the book.
Right.
I mean, just disappears. Yeah, it is. It's wonderful. Everyone should read it.
I absolutely agree. So, everybody, I really appreciate you listening to the podcast. As I said, subscribe on iTunes so you don't have to look out for alerts. Visit the press at kaidrakonis.org. See you next time. Peace out.